Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to the Best of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Today we go into the archives for a program that was broadcast October the 8th, 2011. It was a special program that we did on the passing of Steve Jobs. Stay tuned because at the end of the program, we have a news story.
First, here's Keith with a look at some of the headlines from the world of radio and beyond.
One of the big stories this week is not really connected with radio directly, and that's the death of the IT giant Steve Jobs. Apple itself as a company and Steve Jobs did change the way we do radio. If you go back 10 years ago or 15 years ago, nobody really heard of a podcast. It was really Apple's technology that made podcasts the norm. Today, podcast, it's a new word. Everybody knows it. Jobs was not just an inventor. He was an innovator, the same way as Marconi was when he invented radio and took it to new heights. Edison, who changed music forever with his cylinder recording in the late 1800s. We now have this special report from National Public Radio's Laura Seidel looking back at his life and innovations.
It boggles the mind to think about all the things that Steve Jobs did.
Roger McNamee worked with Jobs on several projects. He says Jobs brought us desktop publishing, computer animated movies, the first commercially successful computer.
Any one of which would have qualified him as one of the great executives in American history, the sum of which put him in a place where no one else has ever been before.
And Jobs was as much a great executive as he was an inventor.
To me, he is of his era what Thomas Edison was to the beginning of the 20th century.
Steve Jobs was just 21 when he founded Apple Computer in his garage in Cupertino, California. In 1977, when Jobs and his partner Steve Wozniak released the Apple II, most computers were big enough to fill a university basement or were do-it-yourself kits for hobbyists with soldering irons.
The Apple II was a huge hit.
Leander Caney is the author of Inside Steve Jobs' Brain.
That was really the first blockbuster PC that anyone had seen, and it made Apple the biggest computer manufacturer in the nascent computer industry.
The Apple II had sound, and it was the only computer on the market with color graphics. You could hook it up to your TV set and play games on it. It also had a spreadsheet program that made it popular with small businesses. But in 1981, Apple got some serious competition when IBM released its first personal computer. IBM had the advantage of its well-known trusted name. Apple countered with the Macintosh. The Mac's signature was that it was easy to use. The Mac was an example of the kind of product that would define Steve Jobs' entire career. Author Caney.
Jobs' idea was that we'll make it easy enough that anybody can do it, a grandmother, a kid, you know, people who don't have any experience.
With the Mac, Steve Jobs introduced the first computer to the public that had a mouse and graphical user interface, pull-down menus and icons. Jobs, a California boy, loathed the kind of conformist East Coast culture represented by IBM. In 1984, when he released the Mac, Jobs sent that message to millions with one of the most famous television commercials of all time. The ad aired once during the Super Bowl. The minute-long commercial referenced George Orwell's 1984. A woman dressed in bright-colored shorts runs into a room of gray-looking people and throws an anvil at a screen where Big Brother, read IBM, is talking.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
Jobs said computers were tools to unleash human creativity.
Part of what made the Macintosh great was that the people working on it were musicians and poets and artists and zoologists and historians who also happened to be the best computer scientists in the world.
That's Jobs in the 1996 PBS documentary Triumph of the Nerds. In many ways, Steve Jobs was the poet of the computer world. He'd gone to India and become a Buddhist. He took LSD and believed it had opened his mind to new ways of thinking. But Jobs' iconoclastic ideals did not always make him easy to work with. Trip Hawkins was the marketing director of Apple until 1982.
He was just a terrible manager and a terrible executive, and At that point in time, I really never thought that he could be a CEO.
In fact, in a boardroom coup, the man that Jobs hired to be CEO of his company, John Sculley, got him fired in 1985. But Jobs was still driven to make computers vehicles for creativity. After he left Apple, Jobs purchased a little-known division of Lucasfilm and renamed it Pixar. In 1995, Pixar released the first animated feature to be done entirely on computers, Toy Story. It's about the secret life of toys, like Slinkies and a talking cowboy doll.
Slink.
Oh, well, all right. You can be right if you want.
Not now, Slink. I got some bad news.
Bad news?
Toy Story was a major hit, and Pixar followed it with other big hits, Bug's Life, The Incredibles, Cars. But in the years since Jobs had left Apple, the company had gotten into trouble. It had less than 5% of the computer market, and most analysts predicted its demise. The board invited Jobs to come back and run his old company. In 1998, Jobs introduced the iMac. Venture capitalist Roger McNamee says once again Jobs helped remake the computer industry. The iMac was the first computer made to harness the creative potential of the Internet.
The transition of consumers from passive consumption of content to active creation of entertainment, so that people write their own blogs, they make their own digital photographs, they make their own movies. And Apple made all the tools to make that easy, and they did it at a time when Microsoft just wasn't paying attention.
Jobs next set his sights on the music industry.
This is not a speculative market. And because it's a part of everyone's life, it's a very large target market all around the world.
There were MP3 players on the market, but none of them were easy to use. Jobs helped engineer the iPod, which he introduced at a trade show in San Francisco in 2001.
This amazing little device holds 1,000 songs, and it goes right in my pocket.
The iPod was a classic Jobs product, easy to use and nice to look at. Apple sold tens of millions of iPods. The iTunes store became the number one retailer. 6 years later, Apple released the iPhone. Again, there had been other devices that put a phone and a music player together, but none of them were as elegant and easy to use. Susan Rockrise, a creative director who worked with Jobs in the late 1980s and early 1990s, says that was Jobs' signature.
Simplifying complexity is not simple. It is the greatest gift to have someone who has Steve's capabilities as an editor and a product designer edit the crap away so that you can focus on what you want to do.
Jobs' last game changer was the iPad. For years, the computer industry had tried but failed to find a formula for sleek computers. And for years, people had been talking about e-books. But it wasn't until Apple entered the market with the iPad that the promise of sleek computers and e-books came together. Rockrise believes Steve Jobs has touched every person who clicks a mouse, sends a photo from their desktop to the Internet, publishes a book at home on their computer, enjoys portable music, or a computer-animated movie. Laura Seidel, San Francisco.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio, heard on the World Radio Network and great partner stations everywhere. On September 27th, the heads of some of the largest media groups gathered in Beijing for the World Media Summit. This included the BBC, the Associated Press, News Corporation, Al Jazeera, Time Warner, Google, the New York Times, Kyoto News, Thomson Reuters, Itar TASS, and the Chinese news agency Xinhua. Sounds like a great idea. But there's a catch. Was censorship discussed? Was blocking of news stories by Chinese internet police discussed? Nope. Were any foreign press invited to cover the summit? Nope. Was any Chinese media attending? Yes. The only story to come out about it was from China's state news agency Xinhua. We spoke to our Beijing correspondent, Jocelyn Ford, who had tried to call the press office where the summit was taking place to get accreditation, but there was no answer. She now joins us to talk about what is being seen as more of a show than a real summit.
let me give you the official line first, okay? It's about cooperation. Can't go wrong with that, right? Partnership between traditional media and new emerging media. Can't go wrong with that, right? I mean, you know, we all want to know what's going on there. It's about research and consultation on the constantly changing media landscape. Okay, sounds good, right? Now,
sounds great. Yeah. Sounds wonderful. I would love to go myself.
But you have to ask what's really going on here. And when I called up various news organizations who had their top honchos, the big cheeses at this meeting, look, people are flying all over the world from Russia Eat Our Task, from the Associated Press, from Reuters, from the New York Times publisher was there. They're flying from all over the world, and I was told, oh, you know, they have 30 minutes each for each topic on the agenda, which happened to include safety of journalists in disaster zones and happened to include intellectual property. They're not saying anything. We're not sending a reporter there. This is not worthy of the reporting. So you have to say, okay, what is this really about? Well, China's policy, as probably you know and many in the audience may know, of going out and having its voice heard in the world, it needs to get some credibility for its media. And what better way than to hold a high-profile, holding court with all of the media moguls from around the world coming and paying attention to you and giving you credibility or face and, getting your message out there through them eventually is their dream. How it's actually working
out. So in other words, then, Jocelyn, this just sounds like a big show.
I think it was. Now, it was a big show that, unfortunately, I can't say anything definitively about because it seems that no foreign media, they had a media meet the press briefing after the conference, which was a one-day conference this year. But I learned about it that day, and nobody answered the phone when I tried to get accreditation, and I talked to other journalists who couldn't get in either, and the only news reports were out on Chinese media. Xinhua was most of them, Russian state media had a report. The report basically said that there will be another conference in Moscow, and we're hosting it. So, it's a bit of a secret, it would seem. Now, I did try to talk to somebody who was there. I messaged him, and he just, I said, well, was anything out there on press freedom issues? Because, you would think that all of these folks coming to China talking about safety of journalists, when one of the main reasons that Chinese journalists, at least, are in prison is because they violated state safety regulations. There was recently a journalist who was reporting on a rape case where women were locked up for years and somebody was apparently murdered. And that journalist was then accused of violating state security because apparently it made the local city look bad and they were trying to enhance their reputation, something of that nature. I mean, did any of this sensitive stuff come up? He said, oh, only in the most gentlest terms. Everyone was very polite. So you have to, say, what are these guys in it for? Why are they coming here?
You see, that sounds a little strange to me because even recently, the Director General of the BBC World Service said that we have to do something to combat media censorship in China. So is he just showing, two different faces when he would go to this conference and just be gentle and not really bringing up the hardcore issues that are on the table?
I mean, at the end of the day, I can only speculate, but I assume it's about business. It's about business deals. It's about foreign media companies not, having in financial troubles around the world and thinking of China as, a possible place to consume their products, and they don't want to offend this possible customer. The other thing on the ground here is that visas for foreign journalists have become rather difficult to get. This year, especially, I've been involved in a survey trying to track journalists who are being refused visas, journalists who are spending 8 months applying for a media bureau here. Some of these are major U.S. media organizations, by the way. Nothing to sniff at. They're household names in the United States. Don't have a bureau here, want to open it, have waited 8 months. So perhaps these types of people are interested in trying to facilitate their work here, shall we say. And mind you, you would think that they might want to make a stink at this conference because at the same time as foreign journalists aren't getting visas or having difficulties getting visas in China, Chinese media is expanding rapidly internationally. Now, I've been told by somebody for the state-run CCTV that they're opening a 50-person bureau in Washington, D.C., and another major broadcast center in Nairobi, in Africa. And, you know, Chinese journalists are traveling overseas, far and wide, and presumably getting visas to do so.
Now, just a moment ago, you mentioned cooperation. One thing I'm just sort of curious about, because, as you know, it is not uncommon to hear, let's say, China Radio International and some other cities around the world. They go in, they'll buy, say, a block of time on a local radio station. CCTV is carried on cable systems around the world. But the BBC, Voice of America, National Public Radio, other major international news outlets are forbidden to have their content airing on local Chinese media outlets, unless, let's say, it's a language lesson. So how do they see that as a business opportunity?
Well, I think, I mean, if you've got companies like Bloomberg, which I don't believe was at the meeting, or at least is not in the presidium, shall we say, the leadership committee, which does involve all the other bigwigs that you've mentioned earlier. But they certainly, China is a huge market for their terminals, their business journals, Reuters Financial News. I mean, they're in competition with Xinhua Financial News. China is a huge market for them. You've got, you know, AP has its TV. It has business relations with Chinese media. I think there's a lot of sharing of material. And again, this is an area where, when China's stated policy is to get its voice heard around the world. And I'm aware of certain deals where CCTV has said, okay, to a European broadcaster, you use our Chinese reporter on breaking news in China, put him on your airwaves, and we'll use your local, your European reporter, and when there's a breaking news story in your country, we'll put him on our airwaves. You see, Baidu is now launching Thai language Arabic coverage. You see, a Chinese company is trying to buy Yahoo, right? Mm-hmm. You see, and Xinhua is trying to make itself more famous. It's bought big screen in Times Square in New York City. So, China is also potentially, you know, I don't know if they're how much business they bring elsewhere in the world, but I do think that it's the business deals to get access to Chinese pictures, access to Chinese information.
Right, but isn't there the risk then, Jocelyn? Let's say a TV network in Europe says, okay, we'll use, let's say, a local reporter to do the story for us. Isn't there then the risk that the story will be censored?
Well, the story will no doubt be from the point of view of China's state, because it's by China's state media. And the question is, and I don't know how many companies may have such agreements if they are already existent. It was sent to me by a reporter who was apparently quite upset by it because the contract which I saw, which was not signed, let me say, specified that the reporter must be a full-fledged employee of that state media, of CCTV. Yeah. Therefore, I mean, you know, people are buying Chinese propaganda or exchanging propaganda. And at a time when other media organizations are having financial difficulties, you can see that this would be a temptation.
It sounds like a way for the censors in China to reach outward with their censorship and to try to have more control. I mean, it's been stated in some articles that I've recently read that in China right now there is more censorship than there was, let's say, 5 years ago.
No, I mean, I definitely think, I mean, China's state, its policy is to have its voice heard around the world. And it's talking about reform at the World Media Summit. It was talking about a couple of things, which from a free media perspective are rather disturbing. It was talking about a common code of conduct. There were no details. And again, I have not read any of the media moguls' views on this. And if it was indeed said at the meeting, this was just a media report. There is also comment about reforming the global media order, whatever that means. I mean, presumably it means we need more friendly news about China. That's friendly, you know, that sort of thing. But that's being a little bit facetious. I mean, that was not stated. It was not written down, but China certainly, the Chinese state media is often saying that for international media is overly critical of China, too much negative news, they want more positive news. And fair enough. I mean, I think it's fine that Chinese media wants to, you know, it should be able to say what it wants. I believe in that. But they should also allow foreign international media to say what it wants in China. And that's the problem of this absolutely no reciprocity here. These folks showing up, it was held in the fancy Diaoyutai guest house. I mean, to tell you the truth, I was ready to, you know, show up at the door of that meeting, but I knew if I went to Diaoyutai and you don't have a pass to get in, they won't let you pass the gate to walk the whole mile to the fancy guest house where the meeting was taking place. So that sort of didn't work out. I actually even wrote to the ombudsman of the New York Times with some of these questions about, you know, what does it say that your publisher is at this meeting, and was, you know, were media freedoms issues, were your principles brought up? Did you try to say how they will fit into this into this World Media Summit? And I was bounced around. I was, you know, I felt like the ping pong ball, ping pong diplomacy here. Told, you're a journalist, go talk to communications. No, but I said, no, but I would like the ombudsman to know if, you know, the ombudsman would address this in a column, was what I was interested in. You know, this should be out in the open. There was no media coverage, virtually no international media coverage of this, and hard questions weren't asked, to the best of my knowledge, which is not very good, as I was not able to get any interviews.
I'm sure that if they had let you in, there would have been a number of red faces.
Oh, I don't know. I'm sure they're all very diplomatic, and they would have just sipped some tea and said, yes, next question.
Jocelyn Ford, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And you're listening to the Best of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. That program was broadcast on the 11th of October, 2011. Corruption is a nationwide problem in Indonesia. And at next year's national election, as many as 200 politicians who serve time for corruption crimes will appear on ballot papers. But as we hear from David Lispen in Indonesia, efforts to shine light into Indonesia's dark corners can be a deadly game for journalists.
There's an old joke that does the rounds in some of Jakarta's diplomatic circles that Indonesia is a country with enormous potential and always will be. There are perhaps many reasons this dynamic and resource-rich nation, which has an annual growth of more than 5%, perhaps hasn't reached its full potential. A land of mountains and islands, its geography is challenging to say the least. Militant groups have discouraged the potential for a mega tourism boom. But one of the most glaring and pernicious economic dead weights here is corruption. On a recent trip to the outskirts of Jakarta for a story about farming, we came across a big new grandstand in the middle of a field. It looked somewhat out of place because the only path to it was a disused, almost undrivable dirt track. On closer inspection, it was totally bizarre because the grandstand looked over, get this, absolutely nothing. I don't just mean no goalposts or line markings on a pitch, I mean no pitch at all. It wasn't even a flat piece of ground, just lumps of earth and old irrigation channels overgrown with weeds. A few laughing teenagers were sitting up in the stand, perhaps wagging school to use it for the only thing it was good for these days, watching the grass grow. Despite its fresh lick of paint, the grandstand had already fallen victim to damage from vandals and graffiti. Another year or two and it would be close to unusable. As a journalist, I must admit a failure when it comes to investigating who was responsible and whether they gained financially out of this grandstand. I just don't have the time to look into everything I see here. But what took me aback was the casual acceptance that the locals had to the grandstand. Oh, it'd just be some politician or party that needed to raise some funds, I was told. They'd have got one of their own construction companies to build it with taxpayer funds and skimmed off the profit. No one I spoke to seemed too upset by it. It was just another unfortunate element of everyday life. Indeed, you see and hear about corruption everywhere here, whether it's expats debating the right price for bribing a Jakarta traffic cop, or the recent news story about the Malang City Council in East Java, where 41 out of 45 councillors were implicated in a bribery case, with so many locked up that the council was unlikely to achieve a quorum. The government institution responsible for weeding out corruption in this target-rich environment is the KPK, the Corruption Eradication Commission, and it's done some brave and impressive work since it was established in the early 2000s. Barely a week goes by when the KPK isn't in the media for busting some low-level politician or public servant, and they've caught some big fish too. In an address to the Jakarta Foreign Correspondents Club recently, Indonesia's most famous corruption buster at the KPK, Novel Baswedan, didn't mince his words. As you already know, he said, corruption in Indonesia is not a secret. It's quite massive. It's pervasive. It is quite prevalent everywhere across the country. He explained the efforts made to fight corruption going back decades and the reason they've largely failed. Political intervention. The problem remains the same, he says. Intervention recurring again and again. But at this time, the intervention has become more substantial and conducted in a more professional way. Novel Baswedan knows more than anyone the danger of speaking so plainly. While investigating a major embezzlement case in April last year, he was walking home from morning prayers when two men on motorbikes threw hydrochloric acid in his face, burning the sight from his left eye. After 10 months of surgeries and eye treatments, he returned to work as a corruption buster at the KPK in February this year, more determined than ever to shine a light in dark corners. After hours, he's also investigating the very acid attack that left him partially blind, because he claims it should have been solved already. Again, he suspects intervention. In my case, he says, there are items of evidence that were eliminated. There were CCTV records that were not used, and there were witnesses who were intimidated. Frighteningly, he says, the cases of intimidation of KPK officials that the public is aware of are just the tip of the iceberg. He cited bombs, attempted murders, and kidnappings that have never been disclosed. As election season heats up here, tackling corruption will no doubt be a promise made by each of the many political parties running candidates. But even before the campaign proper gets underway, there is cause for despair. The Supreme Court has just overruled a KPK regulation that would have banned ex-corruption convicts from running for office. The General Elections Commission, the KPU, says around 40 former corruption convicts are on the ballot papers for legislative seats in the House of Representatives, the Regional Legislative Council, and the Regional Representatives Council. The Jakarta Post even published a handy graphic so you could compare and contrast which party was running the most ex-convict candidates. For the record, Gerindra, the party of presidential challenger Prabowo Subianto, topped the list with 5, while President Joko Widodo's party, PDIP, had none. But it gets worse. The Election Commission says it had previously disqualified around 160 other candidates because of their criminal records in graft cases. The Supreme Court's ruling may see all of them back on the ballot paper, 200 crooks in all convicted of corruption running for office. As a last resort, the Commission is considering putting marks on the ballot papers to indicate which candidates were corrupt in the past. I'm thinking an image of a little pair of handcuffs would do the trick. This is David Lipson in Jakarta.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of the Best of Media Network Plus. If you wish to contact us to let us know how you heard the program, our email address is pcjmedia@gmail.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Pallon, saying 73 and 88 to the ladies.